My interest in this problem was started a few years ago when Merigan Kasur, who is in the Department of Brain and Cognitive Sciences at MIT, came to me with some patterns of orientational preference, which I will discuss later on. And he was interested in some modeling, and I looked at some of the models that existed there, and I thought that using the ideas from statistical mechanics, maybe we could simplify them and sort of extract what was the basis of these models and the patterns that they generated. Now, the original work in this direction was started with a graduate student, Darren Pierre, who at some point in the middle of his thesis had an inspiration that he wanted to become a priest. So he left graduate school, and so this project left hanging in the air. So we had a number of results, but then I didn't really continue until about a year ago, where a postdoc came, Hyun Lee, and he continued that with some of the work. So the outline, I don't know what this project did to him, but basically he's now a Dominican priest and he's found a higher calling. Maybe some patterns emerged as a result of this, I don't know. So I'll briefly discuss, I guess I was going to skip the first part since people in this program would know it, but I see a lot of my friends who are not in the program, so I'll tell them a little bit about where these patterns come and how the input from the eyes eventually ends in the visual cortex, and how a characteristic of the response of the visual cortex is that you have a preference to look at lines, and if you map these lines over the whole cortex, you will get interesting patterns, and then discuss some of the modeling aspects of those patterns. An interesting feature, something that stands out when you look at these maps, are points that are called pinwheels, in which all of the orientations seem to radiate outwards. And to condensed matter physicists, they're just vortices. And the question that I'll ask is why these pinwheels are there in cortical maps. And I'll try to convince you that they could be related to something that has to do with the characteristic inputs that one gets from natural images, in particular the persistence of lines that you see in the natural images. So I think there's potentially a connection between these pinwheels in the cortex and the statistics of lines in natural images. So this is the brief introduction to the visual system. Light coming from the eyes goes to the retina, where there are the photoreceptor cells that convert the input to some analog voltage. And after a little bit of processing, you get the cells called ganglion cells, whose input goes via the optic nerves into the brain. And the output of these are spike trains that tell you whether there is some response to the light that has shone. Okay. The inputs from the two eyes via the optic nerves go into an area of the thalamus that's called the LGN, and after one synapse of processing, they eventually go to the back of the head in an area of the cortex that's called V1, or the primary visual cortex, that is the first stage of dealing with the input from the visual system. And then from here, the inputs go on to more complicated areas where eventually you're able to recognize faces, etc. But what I'm interested in is this part of the cortex. And just to give you some idea of dimensions, it's this area in the back of the head, which is roughly 13 centimeters squared in surface area. It's 2 millimeter thick, and it is arranged into layers. There are 6 layers, and the input from the eyes ends at the 4th layer of the system. And people have been looking at the characteristics of the neurons and the response of the neurons in the cortex and the response of the cortex by a variety of techniques, some of which I will mention during the course of the talk. There are things, microelectrodes, that basically are needles that come and look at the response of a single cell. So you have basically the full response, let's say, as a function of time at a particular point. So this is a very microscopic model, a microscopic technique. And then there are techniques that look at the overall response of the cortex. There are some staining techniques that I will mention, but most importantly, for the types of things that I'm interested, there are techniques that are called optical imaging that basically you can look at what is going on in the cortex in terms of metabolism, and they can tell you the activity that is going on in response to, let's say, looking at set of lines. So I'll come back to this. The classical method for looking at neurons, these microelectrodes, basically you look at the output of a single neuron and you try to guess what is called the receptive field. This is what is this neuron specialized to respond to. And what you find is that if you look at what is coming out of the retina, going up the optic nerve, the cells in that region have a circular type of response field. Basically, a cell looks at some vicinity of it in what's called a center antagonistic surround. So maybe it likes to have light shining on in a central region and starts to activate in response to that, and it doesn't like light shining in the surround region. Of course, the good thing about such a response is that if you have a uniform light shining on the whole system, it basically does a filter. It adds this part and subtracts that part. And if it is nicely tuned, it doesn't show any activity. So it's a very good way to sort of perform a derivative and look for contrast and edges and things like that. Now, once you hit the cells of the primary visual cortex, and this is the interesting discovery dating back now 25 years or more to Hubel and Wiesel, they found that when the monkey is looking at something and they are probing from the cells of the cortex, the response is optimal not when light is shining at a particular spot, but when the shape of the input is something like a line. So the best response is in the form of oriented line, but a particular region of the cortex likes a specific orientation. Maybe it likes vertical, maybe it likes line at this slant, but basically there is a preference to a particular orientation, and it is this orientation preference that I would like to think about. And in particular, if rather than looking at just a single neuron, you try to map the preference over the whole cortex by this optical imaging technique that was introduced by Blasdell, what you find is that the pattern of orientational preference has this intricate shape. So let me explain what you are seeing in this figure. So you go back to the monkey whose picture was in the previous transparency, and in front of it show oriented lines, either in this orientation, etc. Each one of them is color-coded, and by this optical imaging technique, you look at the cortex, and again, the scale here is 1 millimeter, and you find the areas that are responding, let's say, to vertical lines, and you color them green, then you go and show them something at a different orientation, like, let's say, horizontal, and you color them red. Of course, this is a simplified, very simplified version, because in reality, in each direction, you will get some kind of a response, and there is lots of averaging and subtraction, etc., that has gone on into constructing this nice color pattern. But let's sort of stick with this simplified picture. And so what you have here is a two-dimensional map of an orientation that has been presented to the animal, and it has a pattern as indicated over here. Now, one of the things that you expect and is present in this map is that there is some degree of continuity, that is, nearby regions seem to have the same preference. But an important thing is that you also want to be able to respond to all possible orientations. So there is a need for diversity. As you go around, you're going to need to sample all possible orientations. And as a balance between these two needs of continuity and diversity, you have these types of defects. These are points around which essentially all kinds of orientational preferences are present, like spokes going out of the center of a wheel, and so these things are called pinwheels. And a lot of people have been interested in trying to figure out what are the characteristics of these maps and what are these pinwheels doing there, and how do they come about. And in particular, you can have circulation that is going plus 180 degrees as you go around, or it goes minus 180 degrees as you go around. And these two types of defects occur in equal number, as you might expect. What is plotted here is actually the degree of selectivity that you have into a particular direction. So basically, in addition to how much, to which direction you have a preference for, you can ask how that direction is preferred compared to any other direction. So the degree of that, if you like, is the strength of this symmetry breaking that you have at a particular location, and that is plotted here. So you can see there's large variations to that quantity also. Yes. Yes, it's, I think, back, I mean, there are places that are zero. So already once you have zero, you can't really, I can't say it goes over factor of 10% or whatever, so infinity. Okay. Maybe I'll hold on to these transparencies. Actually, another thing that I should show you is another type of map. This is for ocular dominance. So if you look at the response from this, the cells in the primary visual cortex, not only do they have a preference to a particular orientation, but to some degree they respond better to input from the right eye or to the left eye. So there is another map or pattern that is superimposed on this that's called ocular dominance. So basically, alternating bands as you go through this map either respond to the right eye or to the left eye. And this kind of map was obtained in 75 by Levay by a totally different method in which you stain the cortex after the animal has died, and you basically cut it off and look at it. Yes? Okay, let's. Yes, that's right. So I don't really know the full answer to that. If we look at this, we can see that there is some continuity in the selectivity also. You have the answer.
They recorded for pinwheels, they just found, say, the different orientation.
That is, it responded but equivalently to all orientations. Yeah. But I think there are other cells in which you also, when you are at the center of the pinwheel, there is basically no response at all.
Well, that's true everywhere. But
yes.
Today, there is no difference. Look at single cells.
Right. Okay. Statistically. Yeah.
They're just spread over all orientations. That's why you don't see them there.
Right. Okay. So Hubel and Wiesel, when they first recorded from these microelectrodes, they had a model that got the name of ice cubes. So basically, they said that there is a region where you have preference to the right eye, another region that you have preference to the left eye, but then across that region of right eye, as you go from one to the neighboring cell, you have a preference to orientation that rotates continuously. So this is basically looking at the locality of the system. They, at that time, didn't have the global images. And it's interesting that before the global images were recorded, there were also predictions that if you have orientation, maybe you will have these kinds of defects, the pinwheels. And there were sort of generalizations of the ice cube model in which these orientations were where these pinwheels of orientations were arranged into a nice lattice. Now, at the time that Merigan Kasur showed me his pictures and the model that they had, which was some simple partial differential equations, I thought we could do better. But then we looked at the literature, and already at that time, a few years ago, there were, 20, 30 papers, different types of modelings of the system. And by now, I think there are even more. And they are different in flavor, but ultimately I think they share one characteristic that I will mention to you as a puzzle. So given this pattern, you can either try to model it at a very microscopic level, that is, try to think about the response of single neurons and the network that you have of many neurons. That kind of approach, in my view, has some difficulty in that the patterns that you want to obtain for these pinwheels occur at length scales that are in millimeters and centimeters, and you're starting from elements, the neurons, that are at much smaller scale, and also the time scales that you are dealing with for the responses, etc., could be very different. But in this general class of models, you basically present a stimulus to a neural network, and you evolve the connectivities of that network in response to these presented patterns. Let's say you have some set of neurons, and they have connectivities, and those connectivities are strengthened when they are acting in pair in response to a particular pattern that is represented. There are various versions of this model, these kinds of model, and indeed, if you present them with orientations, or even in the absence of, if you present them with various types of stimulus, they develop responses in which there's orientations preferred, and maybe you can even, in some small locality, see the pinwheel emerge. But to generate something that has lots of pinwheels in it would be very difficult for these models, because what they put in is very microscopic, and the patterns that you want to get are kind of global. There is another type of model where rather than to think about the individual responses of neurons, etc., you look at some average response of some particular region of the cortex and represent it by an order parameter. So this is more what we in statistical mechanics would do. And if you are, for example, thinking in terms of this orientation, you represent that by a two-component vector or director that has no arrow, so it's a vector without an arrow. And if you're thinking in terms of the response to the right eye or to the left eye, you introduce another field. And actually, in this kind of model, which is very simple, what you start is with some kind of undifferentiated initial pattern of either orientations or response to the right or to the left. And then you take this and you evolve it with some kind of a filter. So you take a convolution of this pattern with some kind of a filter. And what you find as a result of that is maybe a structure that has pinwheels, etc. So this model has the advantage of getting the kinds of structures that you need in one shot from some random initial condition, but in some sense it is equivalent to doing some kind of an inverse Fourier transform, because what you essentially do for selection of your filter, and a typical filter has the kind of shape that, let's say, as a function of separation, over there I have one Gaussian and another Gaussian subtracted, so it's a structure like this. It is this kind of a center and antagonistic surround type of behavior, and it does the job, but in essence, the way that it has been guessed or produced is you take the initial pattern from the experiment, you do a Fourier transform of it, and that Fourier transform has a power structure like this. And then you deduce that if you were to convolute this power structure with some random initial pattern, you will reproduce this. So it works, it is fast, but in some sense it is not really modeling, it's just doing an inverse Fourier transform. The kind of model that we looked at with this student who eventually became a priest is more inspired by patterns that, rather than you producing them in one shot, evolve gradually as a function of time. So you start with some random initial condition and allow the pattern to evolve as a function of time. And these types of models have been developed very extensively by Swindell. And basically, they again have a structure in which you take some pattern and you convolute it with a filter, which has this center surround feature. But then you use the filter only to change the pattern by a small amount. So it's like a differential equation. And then you have another term that basically stabilizes the pattern so that things don't blow up to infinity. Yeah?
Before you get into this, I guess I'm a little confused about what from the data you showed us, do you see any indication, any of that data showing any indication that there was correlation between the optical dominance and the is there actually data that suggests that? Otherwise, why should one try to model
both simultaneously? Okay. Here's the data that shows the correlations between the two fields. This is the orientation now, rather than being represented as a color, is represented as the slope of the direction of the line here is indicated in this fashion. So these are the pinwheels, and these are the boundaries between right and left eye. And you can see that there is strong correlation, so that the pinwheels typically lie in the center of the ocular dominance bands. And so, although I was going to present this later on in answer to your question, there is indeed correlation between these, and you should look at them in context.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay? So, I don't know what I did with the transparency I removed. Here it is. Okay. So the class of models introduced by Swindell and also others are essentially you have a field and a partial differential equation in which it evolves as a function of time. There is some connectivity to the neighborhood, either a simple Laplacian or a more complicated center surround type of filter. And again, in order to avoid these patterns to blow up as a function of time, you need some kind of a term to stabilize it. And indeed, if you look at these kinds of models, they start with some random initial pattern, and they evolve it as a function of time according to these rules. And you will get patterns that have pinwheels, etc. But as I will show, these patterns have a difficulty in that they are not stable, and if you continue to apply these equations, you will eventually get very uniform shapes. Yes?
Model is based on the assumption of local excitation and long-range inhibition.
Yeah.
You know that this assumption is problematic in the version.
Yes. So the center surround filter, the type of filter that I've indicated here, wants the near neighborhood to have the same type of behavior, so that's called excitatory, while the further regions want to be opposite, and that's inhibitory. So once you look at actual connections, as David is pointing out, there are indications that maybe this assumption that the center is excitatory and surround is inhibitory is not always correct. I'm not sure. Somebody was claiming that it's never correct. I don't think that's justified if you look at these patterns. There must be, because when you do the Fourier transform, you certainly get an indication that there is this kind of filtering going on. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. So the type of thing that I did initially with this student Darren Pierre was most closely related to the work of Swindell and this idea of taking a field and evolving it as a function of time. We wanted to have essentially the most simple and generic type of equations in this type of models and figure out what is the behavior of the simplest generic variety of models that one can have, in some sense divorce ourselves from the microscopic details of what could be going on. So what we noted was that these kinds of equations we encounter a lot in statistical physics, called the Landau-Ginzburg approach to looking at patterns and pattern formation. And in one version of thinking about it, you start with some kind of a cost function, and then you try to follow some kind of a dynamics that minimizes that cost function. And this cost function and dynamics is very much determined and restricted by the symmetries that you want to incorporate. And I think in the end, I'll come back and mention that I think thinking about symmetries is really very important in figuring out why these pinwheels should be there. And of course, for simulations, we have to discretize the model and put it on a lattice. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Right. Yes. Yeah, I've talked to Fred Wolf here a lot, and I think, I mean, historically, as I was mentioning at the beginning, I got into this, and we did this for 5 or 6 years ago with a student who eventually decided to become a priest, so we never wrote it up. So I think most of the references that I wrote up for these transparencies that are 5 years old basically come before, say, Fred Wolf's work. But I think ultimately the answer that I will give is very new, and Fred's models don't give the stability. But I know his work, and I'll discuss it later on. Okay, so let's first think about, just to sort of introduce the model, the concept of trying to think about ocular dominance, which is the preference for the right eye or to the left eye. So here you have a symmetry between two possibilities. And so we could represent that by some kind of a field M that could be positive or negative, positive becoming one eye, negative being the other eye. And since the two eyes are symmetric, you may want to model a cost function that is symmetric under m going to minus m. And since you want the system, and this is certainly known from the sort of development, that if you look at an animal like a cat before it is born, you look across the cortex, there is no ocular dominance, and there is a critical period of development where the ocular dominance develops spontaneously, and it does it even if you were to close the eyes of the animal. And so there is a spontaneous need for the system to distinguish between M and minus M. So we could represent that by a cost function that does not like to sit at zero. So this is zero, but it is symmetric, and you either choose right or left. And the simplest type of cost function in this class is something that is minus m squared plus m to the fourth. It will achieve this kind of structure. And if we try to have a dynamics that tends to go towards the minimum, that's basically what you have. And this is, of course, thinking about a single region in the neuron. So this is basically describing one locality. And then you want to couple the different localities, maybe giving them a tendency to have this continuity and be aligned. And then you evolve this set of differential equations starting from some random initial condition, and you generate a pattern like this that has domains that are preferentially like the right eye or the left eye, and there are domain walls between them. Now, this does not look anything like the maps that I had showed you before. And furthermore, if I continue to evolve this pattern as a function of time, it will get coarser and coarser, and eventually I will get just one of the regions, either black or white, dominating. So I could do better by, rather than coupling things only in a given neighborhood, so I have basically an operator that is like a Laplacian, if I include this center surround type of picture. So what we did here was we basically took the same equations, but in addition to the coupling that wanted to make this neighborhood all be of the same sign, we added a surround neighborhood where there was this inhibitory character, so they wanted to be of the opposite sign. And then when you look at a structure like this, naturally there is now, if you were to take the coupling that I have indicated here and you Fourier transform it as a function of the wave number, there is a structure like a band pass filter. There is an optimal wavelength or wave number. And so the pattern definitely develops a characteristic at that structure, and you get these labyrinthine types of shapes. So I would like to note again that this pattern we get because we are on a discrete lattice. If we were on the continuum and allow this system to really find its optimal minimal cost state, it would be a very uniform pattern of stripes with white, black, etc., something like this. Okay. But there is something interesting. Okay. That depends on what we chose here for the range of the inhibitory couplings. Here I think we had some range that was between 10 and 20 lattice spacing. And again, if you Fourier transform that, the wavelength that you get is somewhere between 10 and 15, and that's what you have. One interesting thing here that was, again, maybe one new feature at that time, is that if we were to do these simulations on an open boundary conditions, like indicated here, what you find is that these stripes come to the boundary at right angles. And indeed, if one were to go back to the picture of the pattern that I had here, this is the boundary of V1, and you can see the tendency of these stripes to come at right angle. Now, in terms of concepts borrowed from physics, one can take a stripe pattern like this and ask what would be the cost of making a surface at an angle, let's say, theta with respect to the stripes. And so what you are calculating is some kind of a surface tension. Because of the anisotropy of the system, you can calculate the surface tension as a function of angle. And if you calculate that surface tension as a result of the excitatory and inhibitory interactions that are not satisfied because you have cut off the system, you'll find that the optimal cut that you can make is when you go at 90 degrees. So maybe the concept of an angle-dependent surface tension is a useful thing to think about why these ocular dominance bands come to the edge of the domain in which they are present at right angles. Okay. By playing with parameters, we can sort of make the other characteristics of the shape, like the branching ratio, etc., look more like what you have in the real situation. But let's go back to thinking in terms of the orientations. So there, in the case of ocular dominance, the symmetry was between the two eyes. Here, let's assume at the beginning that all orientations are equivalent. Maybe there is some question about whether there is a preponderance of horizontal and vertical orientations in your visual field. But I think in the critical period where this selectivity develops, you are thinking in terms of an infant that, from my own experience, does not necessarily stay upright and is constantly rotating with respect to the visual field. So let's imagine that you indeed have a symmetry in which all orientations are equivalent. So one way of representing that is, let's say you have an angle theta, or you can think of it in terms of some kind of orientation that has x and y components, sx and sy, and all of these are equivalent. If you are thinking in terms of an angle theta, you could also represent sx and sy in terms of a complex number. And then the fact that you don't make any distinction between the different orientation means that your cost function should only depend on the magnitude of z, and so you would generalize this cost function to something like this. And if you do a minimization of cost function like that, locally you would have an equation like this. you make some couplings in a neighborhood. Let's here again think in terms of short-range interactions that want to establish some continuity in the map. And you start again with some random initial condition. You evolve it according to this set of equation, and you get a pattern for the orientational preference. That is what is indicated here. And it's a nice color pattern that kind of looks like what we had before from the case of the experiments. If you look, however, at the magnitude of this, so what is plotted in color is the angle. If you look at the magnitude most of the time is actually unity, and at the center of these pinwheels, it goes down to zero. So it sort of comes back and relates to the question that you had asked before about what is going on in the center of pinwheels. This is what comes in these models. So again, you could select according to theta some set of orientations. Let's say something like this being yellow, this being red, green. It doesn't really matter. So, okay? But the bad thing about these models is that at least this version that I wrote down, if I were to continue to evolve the dynamics, what happens is that these pinwheels or vortices come together in pair and they annihilate each other. So as a function of time, you find that the density of these pinwheels goes down. And in fact, if you look at Swindell's model and all the other models, they have this deficiency. So what they do is at some point in time, they say, okay, this looks like a good picture. Let's stop the dynamics and print it out. And okay, maybe there is some change in what is going on in the cortex after some development period, and that's justified, but that is an extrinsic feature that is introduced into the pattern, and it is good to think about why these pinwheels could be stable intrinsically rather than including some reason for them extrinsically. So actually, I mentioned that if I had just use the nearest neighbor type of excitatory connections, and I did the same thing for the Ising variable, I would also get a pattern coarsening. And there, for the ocular dominance, we said that the key to it was to include this kind of center surround competition between excitatory and inhibitory connections. And so you may ask, well, let's try that for the case of this orientation field and see what happens. So we go and add to the equations in competition to the short-range interactions that want to have things to be of the same orientation, some kind of a longer-range interaction that wants things to be anti-parallel, for example. And when we run the dynamics of those equations, we get patterns that maybe at first sight look more realistic, but if you look at them more carefully, you'll see that essentially you have these regions in which you have a pattern where the orientation rotates in a stripe. And so again, the natural tendency of these types of dynamics, even incorporating this, is to go towards patterns of stripes. And if I were to reduce the lattice effects and run this for longer and longer time, I will eventually go to a pattern that is just a rainbow all over the system with the orientation changing continuously.
Does this kind of encounter
counterpart in counterpart in superconductivity? I don't think so. You want to have, basically, think of the Landau-Ginzburg equations for superconductivity. So this part is exactly what I have over here. And then what we have here is something like Laplacian of psi is the standard superconductivity term with a positive mass, h bar squared over 2m. What I have here really corresponds to making the mass negative and having a term like this. Establishes. So what you want is superconductivity in a system with negative mass. Okay? It's an effective mass, so I can't rule out its presence. But yeah, you do have a transition. Okay? So one way, again, of making these patterns of pinwheels don't disappear in superconductivity, actually one has these vortices and they can be pinned by impurities. So maybe what one can do is to incorporate some kind of a non-uniformity across the cortex. Maybe you can say there is no reason why one area of the cortex and some other neighborhood should have exactly the same pattern of connectivities, and so some variations in the pattern of connectivities will provide for you, rather than a uniform landscape in which these things can come together and slide, a non-uniform landscape in which a pinwheel can get stuck and another one get stuck here, and then they can't come together. And so if you add some kind of randomness of any form in the system, indeed what you find is that, first of all, you stabilize these pinwheels to the locations where the magnitude of the selectivity wants to be lower, and secondly, because of the randomness that you have introduced, you basically make the selectivity profile much more fluctuating. But it's again something that is not very intellectually appealing to me, because it's extrinsically incorporated. This is what I should. I don't think there is sufficient statistical information about connectivities, which is what you would need. Yes. Yeah, that's true. And there's lots of things going on there, but well, let's give you one source of randomness that I'm going to use right now, which is this ocular dominance bands. So as you go across the cortex, there are the response to orientation that you want, but also there is the preference to the right eye or to the left eye. And that field also moves along these stripes, but in some kind of a random fashion. So if you like, here already you have some bottleneck and changes in which are quenched and stay there.
Yeah.
I think that
would require that the ocular dominance band form before the orientation.
Yes.
Yeah, that question.
Not in all animals, but in some animals. Yes. So then this. Right. So I offer this as a possibility. I don't believe that that's the case. And I think I'll give you another mechanism that will work in both cat and monkey, because we analyze the maps and doesn't require this. But in sort of analogy to superconductivity, having some non-uniformity in landscape will do the job. And any field, such as ocular dominance, developing before the orientational preference would do the job. So here, maybe in cat, the ocular dominance will do the job.
Yeah, I mean, they probably develop simultaneously, but maybe probably one of two was established earlier.
Yes.
It was very safe.
Right.
But you probably cannot keep them as independent.
Yes.
They develop at the same time.
Right.
Has one tried to add another of all the parameters, like this and two other parameters?
Why would I be showing you this otherwise? Okay? So let's sort of stick to the spirit of these minimal models and think about the simplest type of coupling that you can have between this order parameter with its symmetry and this order parameter with its symmetry. And the simplest thing that you can have that couples them is something of this form. And if you write a coupling of this form, then you have the, I mean, at this level of modeling that I'm doing, the magnitude of these parameters are totally unknown and irrelevant in some sense. But one thing that I have to be careful is whether I make a sign here positive or negative. And depending on the choice of the sign being positive or negative, I will generate two types of patterns when I couple these kinds of coupled equations. And so one sign of the pattern will reproduce the kind of structures that I needed in which the pinwheels would sit in the center of the ocular dominance bands. And that's the one in which this parameter G is positive. And then there is a competition between the two order parameters. So what you want here is that the system wants to break the symmetry either going to right-left or going to a particular orientation. And what this coupling with a positive sign would do is it says that regions where one of them is strong, the other one has to be small, because in some sense, if I were to set this to one, what is happening is that I'm looking at the same pattern in a space when I'm dealing with m squared plus z squared. So I have a balance between the two order parameters. One of them strong, the other should be weak, etc. And so indeed, when we do that, we get the stripe pattern of ocular dominance, and we get the pinwheels that are now stable with respect to the presence of this pattern, because if there's a pinwheel here on one side and a pinwheel on the other side, in order to cross the boundary between them, they would have to go over a barrier that is set by this term, and they don't like to do that. So in some sense, it's the ocular dominance bands, if you like, act like a wall that separates these things from getting together. And so that is one means, but in order to get them to have sufficient difficulty to go across this barrier, we really had to make this parameter rather large, so large that in fact, if you look at the patterns of the strength of the orientational preference, you see something like this, in which the ocular dominance boundaries are very visible. Something that is not really there in the actual system. Okay? But one direction of sort of going. Yes? Yes. Yes. That's right. Yes. And actually, it's a model, if you sort of look at it, the types of constraints, because ultimately, in order to get some coevolution of the maps, one must have some coupling between the orientational preference and the ocular dominance. And if one traces in Fred Wolf's model where that is, it is some kind of a tendency, again, for the system to have extremization of something that is like the square of the two order parameters that represent the two. So his model also falls in this class. Right.
You have to look for the winner.
Yes.
Okay. So you have to find the neural that is
right.
In this minimum condition.
Right.
Right. And this, in this condition, when you treat three features at the same time,
right.
Ocular dominance, orientation preference,
and the retinopathy. Right.
The coupling comes in only in this, with this mechanism.
Yes.
Looking for the next year or the nearest.
Right. But there is a cost function involved in order to decide the winner. And if you look at the cost function involved, what it does is it gives some kind of a cost to the, in addition to these quantities, as you say, there's the retino-optic map. But basically, it treats, it gives some kind of cost to all three of them. And that's how the winner is determined. So ultimately, those kinds of his models, one can massage and think about where the coupling is coming from. It is in associating a cost that is the sum of what you have for ocular dominance and orientational preference and the additional feature that you mentioned. Okay? By the way, he is also unhappy with the characteristics of his model for stabilizing pinwheels, although, again, it goes in some direction in stabilizing pinwheels. He agrees that that's not necessarily sufficient. But, again, going in the spirit of what I mentioned over here, one can imagine that the task that the cortex has to do is to specialize not only with respect to orientations and some selectivity from right versus left, but additional features. And so the cost function could be adding up a lot of things and their individual constraints of symmetry, etc. And yeah. Okay. What the coupling that we did does is, the part that deals with ocular dominance is essentially more or less the same before, and the coupling does not change all that much. So we get the pattern of ocular dominance stripes. We will get the pinwheels, and the pinwheels, because now they have to move in some kind of a landscape that is established by this connectivity, feel some barriers. They don't want to cross these boundaries between right-left eyes. And so they have fewer degrees of freedom. They can't easily come together and annihilate each other. And so this model does a much better job of stabilizing the pinwheels, although it doesn't do a full job, because ultimately the pinwheels can move along the stripes in order to meet and eliminate each other.
Right.
Well, again, in the simulations that we have, the system gets stuck at some point because of lattice effects, etc. My belief is that if we were to improve the simulations, put them on a finer grid and do better simulations, yes, the pattern would. Because I know there's a nice other minimum of energy.
You mentioned the pinwheels like to be in the middle of these
right.
Sides, and this model captures that.
Yes, yeah. So that aspect. Again, it was a choice of
the sign.
The sign, right?
Maybe it's worthwhile pointing out that the patterns that we show here
right.
Are very close to what is observed in monkeys, but not
yeah.
What is
right.
Because you see here, obviously, the ocular dominance pattern that you get
right.
Here is somewhat striped line, or a band line.
Yes. Yes, that's right.
The other one is the orientation preference, rather patch line, if you want.
Right.
Spot line.
Yes. So actually.
But in fact, it's the opposite.
Right.
You have what we call the patch line pattern.
Right. Right. Actually, again, since you mentioned Fred Wolf, one of the things that Fred Wolf does is he shows that he can get two different classes of patterns, one more appropriate to cat, one more appropriate to donkey, depending on which one of these features develops before the others. That is actually contained within our class of equations because we have some time scale parameters. And by fiddling around with the time scales, I can make one of them appear before the other or faster than the other. It's just we didn't really explore the range of those parameters very much, and the picture that I chose corresponded to one choice of these things. So I'm sure that by playing around with the choices of these parameters, I can go in the other direction too. But my feeling, again, I'm sort of presenting these, but I don't think they're the answer is really in any of these things. And so maybe I should tell you where I think the answer is. Okay. Yes. Yes. Right, but that width changes as a function of time. Right, so you have essentially, you can choose a width for that, either ocular dominance or the other, and you choose that, change that as a function of time. To me, is some kind of an additional time scale in the problem, and I can mimic that by playing around with my time scale. So again, my feeling is I'm trying to capture the most generic, simplified aspect of all of these models, and one can do playing around with the parameters. Okay. So where do I think the answer is? So this is my current thinking. So let's back up and explain the problem. And in addition to Fred Wolf, actually, Mitya Shlovsky, who is here also, has a model and asks the same question, which is basically in these dynamical field models, just because of the constraints of symmetry, you are bound to generate pinwheels. So the creation of pinwheels out of some random C is no big deal. It is essentially forced by the symmetries of the problem. But if you believe your dynamics and you continue it as a function of time, there is this problem that the pinwheels are not prevented from coming together and annihilating each other unless you impose some extrinsic features, such as a randomness in the landscape or changing the dynamics as a function of time, which may be realistic, but maybe you don't want to impose for aesthetic reasons. So the question of whether there are models that intrinsically give you stable vortex patterns has been addressed to a limited extent. I think Mitya had a model in which he was exploring his idea of path wire length minimization, and he should really talk about it. And Fred Wolf has a variation of the model, which I believe is not published yet, but I will maybe briefly mention. No, not the one that has the stable. I mean, what he does is he talks about constraints of symmetry on the density of pinwheels. But in his thesis, he has a model which is an extended Landau-Ginzburg with fourth order terms. And that, he told me, was not published. Okay. So I think I should rely on what he told me. Okay. So what are the things that we want to input in the evolution of some field that represent the orientation? And now I'm going to actually use this notation. So sorry about the change of notation. So I'm going to introduce some kind of a two-component object that basically denotes locally which orientation you have a preference for. And I'd like to think about the most generic dynamics that I can write for some kind of a field that represent this. And I want to impose the constraints of symmetry on how these things evolve. And one of the things that seems to be coming up and is an important feature of these maps is that there is a characteristic length scale. So if you were to Fourier transform it, you get this kind of band pass filter shape, and there is a characteristic wave number. And so that you should put in the system or you have available to you. So the minimal type of model that I think about is you have a collection of these distributed across the cortex. So I could be a label of some local neighborhood within the cortex. And the evolution has terms that are local and terms that are as a result of the connectivities to other regions of the cortex. Now, the most important feature of the local models, I think, is to make them, first of all, need to differentiate. So there should be some spontaneous tendency to symmetry breaking towards a particular orientation. So in the Landau-Ginzburg notation, the landscape should be bending down originally, and then it should also, of course, satisfy stability. So the simplest terms to write down are of that form. One can, of course, add higher and higher order terms, but that's the generic simplest model. And then there's some connectivity, which could at some level be linear, and that's the thing that most people are thinking about. And actually, this model of Fred Wolf that is unpublished that I mentioned needs to consider nonlinear connectivity, something like another coupling S cubed, etc. And so I can write that whole set in another fashion, that there is a linear set of operators, let's say this part, and then there is the nonlinearities. And if I impose the feature that I want to have translational symmetry in my system, I can represent the linear part best by Fourier transforming. So I go from a continuous, I go from the discrete regions along the cortex. I don't want to call them neurons because I really think of them as averages of many neurons, towards a continuous field S that is varying across this two-dimensional space. And if that space has translational symmetry, I do a Fourier transform and I get the Fourier components of this two-component vector. Now, practically all the models, and I did a very poor job of summarizing some of the earlier models, and I'm sure lots of other models are there, but I would say that 98% of the models that I have looked at incorporate this thing that I mentioned over here, symmetry between different orientations. That is, all of the orientations are supposed to be completely equivalent to each other. So if I take a field and rotate it across the map by some amount, I should get another map that is statistically possible with the same probability. Of course, another feature is you take this whole picture and you rotate the picture, so you have a rotation in the space that you are looking at, and that should also give you an equivalent thing if the system is isotropic. So under those constraints, the most general linear operator that you can write down is an integral that looks over some neighborhood, a coupling that only depends on the magnitude of the separation between the two neighborhoods. So if you have something here and something here, it only depends on the magnitude, not it doesn't differentiate between this direction and that direction. So that's where the absolute value of x minus x prime occurs here. And then you look at the S that you have at some other region. Of course, this J does not necessarily, it can be any complicated function with characteristics that would reproduce that band pass filter. It could have this kind of center surround feature, etc. I don't care. So once I Fourier transform that, the Fourier transform of this object is the Fourier transform of this kernel, which I can expand, and the simplest function that reproduces this pattern is a constant plus q squared minus q to the fourth. Okay, so we have that. Now, if I just focus on some random initial pattern, the initial evolution of the pattern is completely determined by the linear operator, the nonlinearities set in later on. So in the linearized regime, I have that my S grows with a kernel that is associated with this with some initial condition. Now, it seemed all very simple, but there is an important consequence of this rotation symmetry that is buried into all of this, which is that the x and the y component here are completely equivalent orientations, and they grow with the same rate. Okay, because of the symmetries that you impose in the problem, there is no distinction between two different orientations. It's just your arbitrary choice of what you call the x and y coordinate, and so the two of them will grow with the same rate. So if you start with an initial condition that is compatible with a stripe, so let's say along one direction you have a cosine qx, along the other direction you have a sine qx, and you anticipate that this particular mode that is at the maximum of the linear kernel grows fastest, so you basically select that pattern from the beginning, those will grow with the same rate. And so if you look at that, at each region, you have the same magnitude of S squared, because cosine squared plus sine squared add up to 1. So what you've generated here is a pattern that the orientation rotates like these rainbows along a particular stripe that I have put in by hand. But as a function of this type of evolution, the length of this continues to grow, such that the magnitude is the same at all points. So at some zeroth order, you can say that this pattern will start to grow in amplitude until it hits the saturation level that is set by the nonlinearity, and then it stays. So although I haven't established that the pattern necessarily will go to a rainbow structure, what it says is that this type of linear evolution is not inconsistent with a rainbow pattern. Now, what I would like to say is that, in fact, the real rotation symmetry is different. And what you should think about is that you have a two-dimensional space, and the rotation symmetry that you have is the whole image is rotated at once, which means that if you have a photograph in front of you and you rotate, all of the lines that were, say, vertical will change to some direction simultaneously with the rotation of the line that is joining the two arrows. Okay? So this is a joint rotation in the space of the vector S and the coordinates X. Okay? Would it make any difference? Well, if you look at the kernels that are allowed now, you will see that there is an additional term. In addition to what I had written before, in which, say, the alpha component of the vector S via coupling was related back to the alpha component of the vector, I can have a coupling that goes from any component of a vector at a different location, because now I have an additional vector available to me in the space where I'm performing the rotation, and that's the vector that joins the two of them together. Now, this is inspired by, if you like, this is the book by Shakin and Lubensky, Principles of Condensed Matter Physics, and on the front of it, it has this nice picture that if you look at it closely, it does not look that different from the pinwheels. The coloring is different because of the way that line has shown, etc., but it has a stable pattern of pinwheels. What is it? What it's showing is a film of liquid crystal molecules. Liquid crystal molecules are like linear objects. And these linear objects have what is known as a dipole-dipole coupling, which is exactly this combination of interactions. So if, yeah? No. In the previous case also, you took the whole image and you rotated it. But you allow the rotation of the orientations to act independently of the rotation of the lines joining them. So, for example, you could take the picture in which all of the lines joining the different lines were fixed, but all of the orientations of the lines were rotated by 20 degrees or whatever. And here I'm saying that you cannot do that independently of rotating the lines joining. Now, if you Fourier transform this object, since you allow going from alpha component to beta component in Fourier space, you have a 2x2 matrix whose diagonal elements are the J that I had before, but another object that is fully consistent with rotational symmetry going from S alpha to S beta is Q alpha Q beta over Q squared. And that's because now here X minus X prime was an additional vector in the problem. Here Q is an additional vector. So this is a Q dot Q type of interaction. Okay? Now if you look at this 2x2 matrix and look at its eigenvalues, there are two modes that correspond to basically variations along the direction of the vector that's called longitudinal, and it's like the sound wave that you are hearing in this room, and the other in which the variations in S are orthogonal, and those are the transverse, like the light waves propagating in this room. And as soon as you allow for this additional symmetry and an additional coupling, you have broken the degeneracy between these two modes that you previously had in your system. So now the longitudinal mode and the transverse mode have different growth rates. And I don't care whether one of them is larger or smaller than the other. The fact that they are non-degenerate means that I can no longer superpose them to get some kind of a rainbow pattern. And the feature is that in both of these modes, you will have places where there are zeros, where the magnitude of S has to go to zero. And so that, along with what I know from liquid crystals, suggests to me that this kind of system is a very good candidate for generating and maintaining pinwheels. Okay? So of course, this is the linear analysis. And to check, one has to go and do a model and do things nonlinearly. So what we did was we went and introduced what I call a vectorial generalization of this center surround neighborhood. That is, previously, we had the coupling J that was excitatory in some closed neighborhood and inhibitory in an antagonistic surround annulus. So that's indicated over here. In some neighborhood, you have plus. In some annulus, you have minus. And that's the standard coupling. And this vectorial generalization essentially keeps track of this additional possibility that the line joining locations I and J, Rij, is an additional vector in the problem. So you can have another vector by taking a dot product of S and the relative line and the relative line itself. And this additional coupling, we chose to operate only in the annulus. We could have done it in another feature, but again, another version. But I think as soon as you put in the additional type of coupling, any form of K would do the job. And we thought that it was more consistent with what we knew, that the additional coupling should only work in the surround area. Okay? So then the parameter that is used to tune the presence of this additional coupling is what's called alpha here. And indeed, once we did our... Yes?
The additional coupling just changes the effect of the parameter.
In a manner that is consistent with the direction of these and their relative orientation to the line joining them. So that, in fact, what it prefers is that if there's a point here and a point here, this is a situation where they are parallel. This is a situation that they are also parallel. But in this case, they're also parallel to the line joining them, and here they are not. And it gives an additional energy cost for these two. Okay? And what you find is that if you put no such coupling, the pattern that you generate, and this time we did our discretization properly so you can see what the final pattern is going to be, is a nice stripe, rainbow structure if you like. Once you put any amount of this, whether positive or negative, it doesn't matter, you generate a final ground state or final stable pattern, which is a square lattice. This is not a discretization effect. We did this also on an hexagonal lattice. You get a square lattice of these pinwheels. Okay? So I think generically, so this is a matter of just symmetry principles, I think. Symmetry principles tells me that the generic behavior of models in which they have full rotational symmetry is stripes. The generic behavior of models which have the joint symmetry is these pinwheel patterns. Okay? So is there any indication that this kind of coupling is actually present in cortical maps? Yes.
And their orientation.
Yes.
But not between the position of the cortex and their orientation.
You have to tell me the difference. I indeed think that there is a retino-optic map. So if I were to give you a sort of a square lattice on the cortex, I will have some corresponding lattice. And what
on
I
scale, yes.
Yeah.
But so, not on the scale of pinwheel.
Yeah.
So on the small scale there is not a variable correspondence between the two variables.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that therefore mm-hmm. you know, those two variables are not equivalent.
Right. So what is actually performed for the simulations is a mapping indeed between the orientations and actual distances on the cortex. To what extent those actual distances in the cortex are correlated with via the retinoptic map to the visual field, actually, I don't really know that much. So you can correct me on that. Okay? So the real test of all of this story, this is a nice story of patterns, etc., is does it have any relevance to the actual cortical maps. So we should go and look at maps that already are there for a variety of animals. We did analysis of cat and monkey visual maps that I'll show you shortly, but there is actually already from tree shrew, which doesn't have very well developed ocular dominance band, a different type of evidence, which is as follows. This is a nice experiment by Bosking et al. In which they simultaneously did injections to a particular area of the cortex, and then they can follow where the biocytin that they injected left traces, so they know what the connectivities are. And simultaneously, they could do a map of the orientations. And so what they found was that there was a tendency that if you were to inject things at some point, the connectivities would not go in all direction, but there was a preferred direction. And more importantly, that preferred direction in some cases, not in all cases, was, I think in the majority of cases, so there's statistical correlation. The direction in which these connectivities went from a particular point was correlated to the orientation preference of the point that they had injected the thing to. So it is like this asymmetry that I had indicated here, that there is a difference if you're going along some particular direction, whether the orientations are along the line connecting the two or orthogonal to the line or connecting the two. I don't say that it is there for all neurons, etc. In fact, they don't say it, but I think there is statistical evidence for some anisotropy such as this. That I don't know. You should tell me about it. What we did was we took a map from monkey, something like this. Then I guess I had a picture here. In the map from the monkey, you basically have orientations across the system, so you can take some particular origin, let's say the orientation there is preferred to be at some angle theta 1. You look at some annulus in the vicinity or around that point, and you do a histogram of the orientations that you find preferred in that annulus simultaneously. So this is a histogram as a function of two coordinates. One of them is the two orientations relative to each other, theta 1 minus theta 2. The other is theta 2, it could have been theta 1 or the sum, relative to the angle of the line joining them. Okay? So if this kind of coupling that I mentioned was not present, if all orientations could be selected independently of the line joining them, then what you would find is that these histograms would not depend on the second argument. Okay? So what do we find? Indeed, what we find is that if you look at these histograms, for annulus that are very close, short separation, there is almost no dependence on the second coordinate. So there is no indication of this anisotropy in coupling in the small short vicinity of some particular point. But that if you go further, this tendency appears. And so the histograms now have a developed dependence on the second coordinate. And just to make things clear, what is plotted here by the two lines are what you would get at this second angle being either zero, so structure like this, or at being at its maximum 90 degrees. So for short distance, there is no statistical indication of this anisotropy in the monkey cortical map. For some intermediate distances, there is quite a visible distinction between this angle being zero and this angle being 90 degrees. So this is, I'd like to see what you had in mind, experimental evidence from monkey. This is indirect because all we did was we made histograms of maps for the monkey. Yeah. Okay. So this is some relative angle with respect to line joining them and the orientation. So this angle ranges from 0 to 180 degrees. But it's a two-dimensional plot, so from something like this, maybe you don't see things very clearly. So what we've done is we've selected the trajectory that is at 0 degrees and the trajectory that is at 90 degrees and just plotted them over here. So these are just two of the raster lines that you see over here projected here.
So can we just pick one point, and so if I pick the solid line, then the fact that it goes low and zero means that there are...
Okay. So let's think about this line that I have at zero. Okay, that's this. Okay, and then we have one at 90 degrees, so that would be somewhere in the middle of the surface, and that corresponds to the dashed line.
Sure, but I'm trying to intuitively, can you just draw the coordinate situation?
Okay, so what it says, this dashed line, let's imagine that that's roughly a constant, which is what it is, which says that if you have an orientation like this and go at a direction that is 90 degrees to it, the second orientation can be more or less anything. Okay? Whereas the 0 degree line says that at this particular range, if I have a situation that is like this, the second one does not like to be like this, but likes to be like that. So this is... I don't.
You're saying that there is a line like that.
Yeah, at this range of length scales. You see, this thing is actually varying in tendencies as you go over the size of the annulus. So at short distances, the preference is certainly things to be parallel. At this particular range that is shown over here, the tendencies are as indicated here. As far as I'm concerned, really the most important feature is the presence of anisotropy. One cannot think about why at this distance the preference is towards this orthogonal orientation versus parallel orientation. That's a legitimate question. I don't have at this stage an answer. Interestingly, again, if you go and look, this was for the monkey. We did the same for the cat. I think I have the cat somewhere. It is exactly the same. Okay, so finally, maybe this was the point that you were raising. Why should there be such an anisotropy? And I think it has to do with the statistics of natural images. That is, if you look at the world around you, there are lots of lines, but these lines have the tendency to persist. And I think even if you had an animal that was forced to lay on the ground, look up at a cloudy sky so that there was no variation in light and rain, but every now and then there were flies buzzing over its visual field, the persistence of motion of the flies would give a similar effect of persistence of lines. So this kind of tendency of natural images to have line segments that are persisting gives this anisotropy to the input that you have to the maps. So if the cortical connections somewhat respect the connectivities of the input, they must have that. And this is maybe the paper that you were mentioning with Gilbert and Magnasco, where they looked at the statistics of oriented lines in the visual image, and the reproduction here is very bad, but basically they see that if lines are collinear, there is a tendency for their persistence. So as they rotate these two, they basically that tendency goes away. So in fact, what I was showing here for the cortical map is an opposite tendency to what you have here for the statistics of natural images, but both of them definitely have the anisotropy. So my final sort of conclusion is that there are certainly at one level pinwheels in the cortex, and if you don't incorporate extrinsic factors, there is the puzzle of what intrinsically stabilizes the pinwheels. And I think that the answer, if you think about symmetries and generic behavior of patterns with symmetries, could lie in the presence of anisotropy between transverse and longitudinal directions in the connectivities. And that could in turn reflect the statistics of natural images. So the statistics of natural images could be the reason why you have pinwheel stable in the cortex. Thank you. In the models that I used, the only input was the random initial condition. In some of the models that the neural network models and some of the models that Fred Wolf is using, there is a constant presentation of the model with external images, and the connectivities, etc., change in response to that. So then you have to select the statistics of the input images correctly. Yeah. I think if I then abstract those models and think about, okay, those models somehow represent some tendency ultimately to have some orientation preference, and this orientation preference via some dynamics evolves as a function of time. As long as there is some symmetry present in the way that the inputs are present and things are processed, I don't care exactly what the connections are, I could present them in this generic structure and think about the symmetries and their effects. Yes.
The
Absolutely. Well, again, I'm guided by this prescription, as you said, for superconductors, etc. So we have at one level the macroscopic description, in which you have as input only the symmetry, and what you have are these parameters that would occur as coefficients that you don't really know. Then you have the microscopic models that have the underlying symmetries, and what you really want to do is to coarse grain them and somehow abstract from them what the values of these parameters are. Now, that procedure of going from microscopic model to macroscopic model in statistical mechanics like superconductivity is extremely difficult. And one constructs specific models, and for the specific models by a variety of different numerical techniques, etc., you obtain estimates for these coefficients. But when presented with that, I'm always skeptical that you got the microscopic model right. So until you can convince me that you have a very good description of how the neurons behave and their connectivity and synapses, and you have put all of those things correctly, I'm not sure there is that much value in me launching on deriving macroscopic parameters based on that particular microscopic model. So. Yes.
Some idea about connectivity and the fact that there are inhibitory and receptor neurons.
Right.
And nothing that they're not to calculate exactly the parameter of N12.
Yes.
I
agree.
1.2, but
yes. Yes, I agree. For example, one could, in principle, if you believe that there are connections, excitatory and inhibitory, which to some extent you know how they vary as a function of distance, and they are more or less linear, you could always, by a Fourier transform, convert them to a curve like this for a power spectrum, and that is really one of the inputs in these kinds of macroscopic models. It gives you the length scale, it gives you the growth rates, it gives you lots of things that if you were to then simulate the connectivities using this particular filter that is derived out of your microscopic models, in principle, you should be able to do much better detail of getting the persistence, the branching, all of those things right. Thank you.